Minus six. Many thanks, Ray, for the introduction. I have one request. Can one turn this volume a little bit down? Because I hate to hear myself so much in the speakers. Is someone doing that? Turn the volume down a little? Okay, thank you very much. And also the lights a little less, because I like to talk to people and not to the lights, if possible. Okay. Now, I see some senior guys sitting here. And I want to say in the beginning, I'm not talking to them, I talk to the students, okay? So you will hear a lot of things which you know already, and you will also hear some advertisement of my view of quantum mechanics, which some of the older guys will not like, but I want to convince these guys here, okay? Because they are the future. Now, I want to, as Ray kindly mentioned, I'm doing experiments, and I would like to quote someone very famous who said the following, and I write it on the blackboard because I like it so much. After all, write it down in your notebooks. After all, physics is an experimental science. You will never guess who said this. This was said by a theoretical physicist. It was said by Usher Paris, who, as you know, passed away recently, who was one of the theoretical leaders in the field, Usher Paris. So the point is that I would suggest that even when we talk about theoretical ideas, we should always make clear how it connects to experiments. I know that there are areas of modern physics where this is a problem, but it's not our problem in quantum physics. Now, I should also mention, just that the younger guys get to know me a little better. I started to work on these things, on foundations of quantum mechanics in 1975. So we actually could celebrate this 30 years now in neutron interferometry. So we studied meta-wave interferometry. This was, as Ray mentioned, with Helmut Rauch in Vienna, who was my supervisor. And at that time, the interesting difference compared to today was that there were nearly no conferences on the field. There was only one conference in 1975 devoted to foundations of quantum mechanics and experiments and this kind of stuff. It was a very small community. Bell's theorem was just taking off in terms of experiments, so it started to have an impact. And that I would like to stress that there was no feeling whatsoever that what we are doing might be useful for something someday. There wasn't, all these early experiments about quantum interference were just done out of curiosity. We just wanted to play with the stuff and wanted to see how it works. The fact that, you know, afterwards with all these discoveries in entanglement and experimental breakthroughs, this led to quantum communication, quantum computation and so on, is a complete surprise to me. And I like to stress this all the time when I talk about the importance of fundamental science. If you want to have something real in you, you should never ask for possible applications. Now, what we do in meta-wave interferometry is essentially this kind of experiment shown up there from the Bohr-Einstein dialogue, the two-slit experiment, or variants thereof. The two-slit experiment, is there a pointer somewhere? That doesn't matter, people know that. This picture is actually taken from Niels Bohr's write-up of his discussions with Albert Einstein, and I strongly suggest that you read this. It is written is by Niels Bohr, discussions with Albert Einstein. Niels Bohr. Discussions with Einstein. with Einstein. I just write E here. Okay. And this is written up in a volume, but you find it on the internet. Written up in a volume, edited by a person called Schilp. It's the title of the book is Albert Einstein, Philosopher Scientist. Many things. Okay. Albert Einstein, Philosopher Scientist. This is a collection of articles by many famous people from all kinds of fields referring or connecting to work of Einstein. And there are a couple of interesting open questions in there which are still open today. So if you find, you want to find an interesting open question, you might find it actually there in a book which is more than 50 years old. Published 1948, if I remember correctly. Okay. And as you probably know, I don't know, did you talk about the Poe-Einstein dialogue already here? Not yet. This is one of the most fascinating dialogues ever, I think, concerning foundations of physics. It was a dialogue which took place between Niels Bohr and Albert Einstein in the late 20s and early 30s of the 20th century. And the question was basically in the interpretation of quantum mechanics. The question was, what does it all mean? Now, the graph here is taken from that discussion. This drawing was made by Niels Bohr. And I really like it. I really like it because it shows attention to detail. Look at the screws here. You see, and this is not just a joke. These screws were important for Bohr because the screws keep the apparatus together. If you don't have the screws there, if the pieces of the apparatus are able to freely move with respect to each other, you have a completely different experiment. Okay? Now, you know, the discussion simply is you have something coming in from the left, say light, and if both slits are open, you illuminate the pattern you get on the observation screen consists of dark and bright stripes, which simply are due to interference. I'm sure you talked about that point. So I have two openings in a screen, and one usually draws this pass through. This is freshman physics. Opening in the screen. One usually draws the pass here, and here's the observation plane, and you have possible pass. And you get destructive interference whenever these two waves are out of sync, and constructive interference when they oscillate in phase. Now, there is an important point already here to be said, and that is when you do this experiment with individual particles, one by one, and this was done with individual particles, with neutrons, electrons, also with individual photons. There was an experiment done by Birgit Topfer, who is now the wife of Gregor Weiss, who sits here, where we had about, the intensity was as low as about 50 photons per second. So really one photon after the other. Most of the, in this single particle experiments, most of the time the apparatus is empty. And sometimes an individual particle passes through. And you collect them all, and you get the interference fringes here, which you simply calculate as psi 1 plus psi 2 absolute squared, right? The superposition of the two waves which have come through the two slits. Now, the important point is is one observation. The question is now, does quantum mechanics refer to individual systems or to ensembles? The important observation is that that if you open both slits, you get these fringes. If you close one slit, you get no fringes. That simply means that when you open up both slits, there are locations on the observation plane where you never detect the particle. You never observe a neutron, photon, molecule, you name it. And this simply means that each individual particle knows that both slits are open. Because each individual particle knows that there are certain places on the observation screen where it should never go. This argument is even stronger when you build up what's called a Mach-Zehnder interferometer. Can I erase this? That's a very important point for me. Namely, quantum mechanics refers to individual systems. It's even more stronger when you talk about the Mach-Zehnder interferometer. This is, for us experimentalists, this is really the working horse for most experiments. It's not as famous as the double slit, but in a sense more basic. What you do is you have a beam coming in. Mach and Zehnder were two guys. Mach was Austro-Hungarian, and Zehnder was a Swiss guy. So the two did not work together. They just discovered this independently. You put here a half-silvered mirror. Okay? So a half-silvered mirror works the following way. If I have a state coming in here, which I might call A, and if these are beams B and this is beam C, B and C, then what the half-silvered mirror does, it splits the beam such that A becomes the superposition of 1 over square root 2 B plus I C. Okay, the ket here simply says, describes the state of the particle being in that beam. So what you get is you get the superposition of the particle being in beam B, being in beam C, with the same amplitude. The amplitude is 1 over square root 2, which means that there is a square of it. 1 over square root 2 to the square is 1/2, to find the particle either in B and C. But this is a coherent superposition. The same way as in the double slit experiment, you have a coherent superposition. The I, by the way, comes from unitarity. It's a phase jump upon reflection. Now we add two more mirrors here. These are now fully reflecting mirrors. They are the same, so we don't have to worry what they do. And then finally we put here again a half-silvered mirror. Another half-silvered mirror. Okay. So we put these waves together, and if we, you now can, you have already the machinery to calculate it if you want. You can use the same way as the first mirror acted, this second mirror acts on these incoming beams, and the result is that if these paths are of equal length, the probability to find a particle here is 1, the probability to find a particle here is 0. For each individual particle. So if you send in, well, why is this the case? It's simply because of interference. You can easily see that the two paths going through are these two. Now, for a particle to end up here, there are two possibilities. It either goes through this way, or it goes through this way. And we have a superposition of both possibilities. You can see that the particle on both paths experiences the same interactions, but just in different order. Here it first passes through the semi-reflecting beam splitter and is then reflected. Here it first is reflected and then passes through. if these two operations interchange, if the corresponding operators commute, which is true for most bona fide beam splitters, then it means that the wave coming here is in phase. The two waves coming here are in phase, they constructively interfere. Likewise, if you look at this outgoing path, then there are two possibilities. Either the particle went through this way, which means no phase jump, no reflection. This one we ignore because it's the same here. And here we have a reflection here and a reflection here. So we have twice a phase factor of I, and I squared is minus one. So we have here two waves which interfere, which are completely out of phase, so they destructively interfere. This is destructive interference. And this holds for each individual particle. You don't need to collect an ensemble. Each individual particle knows that it has to end up here, not here. This is clearly due to interference, because if I block one of the beams, what will happen? If I block one of the beams, then say this one, then the particle can only take this path. So it, in this last beam split, it will be split with equal probability here and here, and there is then interference here. There's intensity here. There's intensity here. So one beam blocked. If you have one beam blocked, this is, it turns out that in the end, outgoing here, I have here P equals 1/4, and here P equals 1/4. Why 1/4? Because if I block this path here, I put an absorber here, the particle is already absorbed here in 50% of the cases. Now, this idea has actually been applied to do something very elegant. And that is the idea by Elitzur-Weidmann. The idea was put forward sometime in the early 80s. I would like to write this down now. So I really want to give you the feeling that we talk about individual quantum systems, not about statistical ensembles. And actually, much of the experimental progress in the last 20 years is due to the fact that people were able to play with individual quantum systems. And all the applications in quantum information, the same story and so on. Elitzur-Weidmann, this to me is a really beautiful idea. Two of our friends from Israel, I forgot the exact time, it must be about 1990. You can look it up on the internet. The question simply is, this is really fantastic. The question is, suppose you have a bomb which has an extremely efficient trigger. They called it the super bomb. Super bomb. It's such an efficient trigger that if anything hits the bomb, it will go off. So if only one photon, for example, hits the bomb, it goes off. Okay? The question is, can you detect this bomb, the presence of this bomb in a room, without blowing it up? Okay? One photon triggers it. Can you detect the presence of this? You would simply say, no, it's not possible, because I have to send at least one photon in, and if that photon hits my thing, it goes off. Yes? Sorry? Yes, you could probably try schemes like gravity, to measure its gravity and so on. We have to worry about what this means in terms of a quantum picture, whether there's some gravitons exchange or whatsoever, you know. I'm sure I can find a way this doesn't work. Now, the idea of elixir of Weitman is very elegant. And that is simply take a Mach-Zehnder interferometer the way we just had it here. Take a Mach-Zehnder interferometer and place the bomb here. Here is our bomb, B. And I draw this just as a dashed line here. Place the bomb there. And send in only one photon. Something which we can do now in experiments routinely. This is another piece of information I want you to take home. We can routinely send an individual photon wherever you want. This is not anything advanced anymore these days. Okay, so send one photon in. Now what will happen? Here at the beam splitter, we get the superposition of the photon being here and the photon being here. Which means that we find the photon in half of the cases in this beam. In the half of the cases, it will pass on. If the photon is in this beam, we have a problem. The bomb will go off. Okay? So with a probability of 1/2, the bomb will go off, and you have to build a new laboratory. Okay? But if you are lucky, in the other half of the beam, half of the experiments, the photon takes this path. P=1/2. What can happen then? It hits our semi-reflecting mirror, and there again, there's a 50-50 chance this is semi-reflecting mirror. For you guys, in the old language, this was called half-silvered mirror, but nobody uses silver anymore to do this experiment and so on. So forget it. Okay, there are much better ways to do this. Okay, so what will happen here? If the photon comes here, it will, with the same probability, it will go this way or this way. So with a probability of 1/4, it ends up here. With a probability of 1/4, it ends up here. So if I put detectors here, if I put the detector here, and it makes click, what have I learned? Nothing. Because this detector also makes click if the bomb is not there. But before we learned, if all the paths are open, the particle always goes there, it never ends up here. So if this makes click, we have learned nothing. But if this one makes click here, this one makes click, we know that something is obstructing our beam path. Because if the beam path is free, if there's nothing in the trajectory, the photon, the one photon we use, never ends up here. Okay? So if this detector clicks, we know that the bomb is there, and the bomb is still alive. Because we have only one particle, and the one particle can only be registered once, either in the detector or by the bomb. Now this kind of experiment was an experiment which we did sometime in the mid-90s. The main people on the experiment were Paul Quiert, Harald Weinfurter, and then there was also in this time was Mark Kasevich visiting us, who then, you know, he's now became famous for developing these beautiful rotation sensors with atom interferometers and so on and so on. And we clearly, I mean, we didn't do the experiment with bombs, but put a detector here, that's quite obvious, but it simply works. But one more important point is, I don't want to go into this into detail here now, I just want to trigger your appetite. You could say, okay, this is not a very economical scheme, because in half of the cases the bomb goes off anyway. You can improve this. And you can improve this such that in the limit the bomb never goes off and you always know whether it's there or not. By simply sending a beam through the bomb many times with very, very small amplitudes. Okay. You can find this in our papers if you look it up. So all the message here, why do I go into so much detail here? The message here is that you can get practical information by playing with individual particles. No statistics necessary at all. End of this part of my talk. Other part of my talk, when we worry about these experiments, we can also worry about whether quantum mechanics is correct, whether quantum mechanics is the correct theory. And there have been a number of tests of the linearity of quantum mechanics, even experimental tests, which are quite interesting in the way one does them. But unfortunately, they show that quantum mechanics is correct, so they are not that important. Okay, they would be much more important if quantum mechanics turned out to be not correct. But you can experimentally test quantum mechanics, and where you essentially test the linearity of quantum mechanics. Test the linearity of quantum mechanics has been tested in experiment, QM. Because the point is that there are various sorts of linearities and various sorts of generalizations. You have heard one of them. You have had Philip Pearl talk here. The point is whether you can avoid some of the conceptual problems by having the Schrödinger equation to be non-linear. There are some experiments which rule out this kind of stuff up to a point, and an experiment can never rule out an alternative, definitely, but only up to certain limits which make it more and more implausible why quantum mechanics should not be non-local. For example, if you think about a theory which keeps wave packets from spreading, my understanding is, but one should study this in more detail, my understanding is that the present limits of the maximum size a nonlinear term in the Schrödinger equation could have and not be in conflict with experimental observation already implies that wave packets have macroscopic size. And that was the moment when I decided that this is not very interesting anymore. So I should like to stress, when we have this debate about quantum mechanics, that there is on the one side the discussion about the interpretation, and I will say more about this in my talk on Thursday. And on the other hand, there are people who propose alternative theories. So if you have a nonlinear modification of quantum mechanics, you really talk about alternative theories which can be ruled out in an experiment, and it is my conviction that they will be ruled out in an experiment. Now, okay, let me continue and now talk about some more practical experiments, some more recent experiments which we actually did in my group in Vienna. So a question which we ask ourselves, such experiments of matter wave interference have been done with many kinds of particles, with electrons, neutrons. Actually, the first interference experiments with electrons were already done in 1930. That is interesting to know. In Germans, Stern was one of them, the famous Stern from the Stern-Gerlach experiment. electrons with new experiments with neutrons, atoms, small molecules, and so on. And the question which we ask ourselves, is there a limit? How far can you go in observing these quantum interference phenomena? You know, the sloppy way to talk about this kind of stuff is that in the double slit interference experiment, the particle goes through both slits. I advise you never to use that language, because it doesn't have any meaning. Interference arises if there is no information where the particle goes through. And that is very different from saying it goes through both slits. If you, as soon as you believe that particles go through two slits, at once you can believe in anything. So then it really becomes crazy. So one has to be a little bit more cautious. Now, the question is there a limit in terms of mass, complexity, temperature, and so on? This is interesting for two reasons. One reason is, and that again connects to the question of interpretation of quantum mechanics, in the heads of most people, the distinction quantum classical, whether the system is quantum or classical, is the same distinction as the distinction micro-macro. Okay? And I would simply want you to take home there is no reason for that position. It is just a question of experimental development that we aren't very far yet. We are still far away from observing the superposition of cats, for example, Schrödinger's cat paradox. But I believe, I don't know how long I will be alive, but if I reach my, you know, usual life expectancy, I believe that we will see quantum interference of objects which are large enough that you at least can see them already in the microscope. There's no fundamental reason why this will stop somewhere. There are all kinds of reasons when you read papers why we will never observe all kinds of papers claiming that we will not why we do not observe interference of macroscopic bodies. The way I want you to read it, these papers, and the way I read them is their arguments are always correct, but find a way around that particular argument presented there. Just be a clever experimentalist and you can probably make an important impact. So this is not the same. So the two are not the same. And we want to demonstrate this in experiments. We want to show quantum interference for macroscopic bodies. Okay? Second point is that this might be important because people talk about quantum computers and all kinds of stuff where they want quantum states of large systems. And the question is how to keep them alive, how to keep them from decoherence. The kinds of experiments which we started in 1998, this was started together with Markus Arndt, who was working with me as a postdoc at that time, and he now took over this research program completely on his own. The kind of experiment we started was to simply look at the diffraction at first, not at double slits as I showed you before, but at multiple slit assemblies. But that's essentially physically the same. Okay, multiple slit assemblies like this one, where we have a grating constant of 100. Nanometers, very, very fine microfabricated gratings. We use fullerenes, as I showed them before. These fullerenes are significantly larger than anything else which showed quantum interference before. We produce the beams in an oven at high temperatures. I will come back to the temperature a little bit later. So another story is, one need not to work at low temperatures. To see quantum interference phenomena, it's easier to see them at low temperatures, but there's no basic, no fundamental reason for them. It's harder at higher temperatures, that's quite clear, but it's not, there's no basic reason. So these molecules are heated up to quite high temperatures, typically of the order of 900 Kelvin. So quite hot. What happens is that fullerenes, carbon 60, carbon 70, are so tightly bound as the molecules themselves that they don't easily break up. And at this temperature, they simply evaporate from a powder. So you have a powder, you evaporate them, and out comes your beam. We can then simply, the speed here is of the order of 100 meters per second to give you a feeling for the velocities. And here we have mechanical wheels by which we are able to select molecules with a certain velocity, because what comes out has a very broad velocity distribution according to the temperature. Okay? So then we have a slit here, we have another slit here to collimate the beam to make a very fine beam, and back there we have our grating. The distances here are important, about 1 meter. Another 1 meter back, we observe the interference pattern. It's actually an elegant procedure, which was the idea of Markus Arndt. We developed it ourselves. You have a high power laser, which is focused down to a few micrometers diameter only. So very high light intensity. Now what happens is that the molecules passing through here get heated up so much that they get ionized, and then you can easily detect these charged molecules. Very nice. The advantage of such a detector is, as experimentalists, we have to worry about all kinds of practical things which a theoretician doesn't have to worry. Like, for example, in our gas chambers, we always, these experiments take place in vacuum. We always have a background of other gases, like oxygen, nitrogen, argon, and so on. And these could also be detected by some detector. The advantage of this apparatus is that if you do it right, only the large molecules get ionized and not the small ones. So you don't see the small ones. Okay? So, in the experimental pattern looks like this. Experimental pattern looks like this. These are the observed intensities. Counts in 100 seconds. You see at 100 meters per second, typically, you really have them one by one. You know, they zoom through the apparatus in 10 milliseconds. Okay. And so you collect them at the various positions and you see the interference stripes, maximum, minimum, and so on. The solid line here is prediction from standard diffraction theory, like you learn it in optics. Standard, as it is called, Fraunhofer diffraction theory. You don't have to know anything about matter waves to calculate this. You don't have to know anything about quantum mechanics. But it's a distribution of individual particles. Okay? Individual particles. Okay. So, here's the red line. And now it fits quite nicely, the experimental observation. With one problem, there is the side order maxima are higher than what theory predicts. So, in a sense, the experiment works better than what you would have expected from theory. This is actually something which happens often in quantum experiments. They very often work better than what you expect. Now, does this mean that quantum mechanics is in trouble? No, it does not mean that quantum mechanics is in trouble. Simply means that the picture which we have to calculate these patterns using standard optics is too simple. We have to add something that's quite interesting, actually. We have to add the van der Waals force and Casimir interaction. The point is, I just want to draw this here. What really, the way the experiment really looks like is for a molecule coming along, it actually sees a channel. I don't know often now how thick the grating is. So these openings here are actually channels, one channel next to the other one that the molecule has to pass through. So here's a channel. Okay. Then there is the next channel, and so on. Okay. And what you see there, these interference fringes are because of superposition of amplitudes which pass through the different channels of one and the same molecule. Okay. Now, the point is that if you look closely, the molecule could either pass through it various ways. It could pass, you can consider this trajectory here, or you could consider a trajectory which is closer to the walls. Now the point is that there is interaction of the molecule with the walls, namely van der Waals interaction, and kind of induced dipole interaction, and Casimir interaction. The fact that because there are these walls here, the vacuum is restricted. There are not so many virtual states available. And this simply means that the molecule passing through here experiences a different potential when going through. Any interaction means potential than going through here. And a different potential means a different phase. Because the phase you get a phase shift along some trajectory, integral phi of phi of let's write a subscript I here, where I the numbers the path here, and the original side, and the phase is simply given as integral v dt over h bar. The integral of the potential the particle experiences while propagating along the trajectory over time divided by h bar. Now this integral is different when the molecule goes through here from going through here. So what that means is that the wave front, if you look at the wave coming out, if you come in with a horizontal flat wave, it turns out that the wave afterwards is bulged, the wave front. It's not a flat wave front anymore. That simply means that our effectively, in terms of phase, the homogeneous part where the slit is phase homogeneous is narrower. This is just, you know, we calculate all this, but I want you to understand what's going on. The part where the phase homogeneous is narrower. That means that effectively the slits are narrower in terms of phase. And that means, as you know from optics, that higher order fringes are populated more strongly. This is known from standard optics. So the fact that we observe Casimir interaction there is actually quite nice. You know the famous saying by Feynman, Richard Feynman, one of his famous sayings, he was famous for famous sayings, is, how does it go? Yesterday's sensation is today's calibration and tomorrow's background in experiment. Here, the Casimir force is already a background, which was a sensation some days a while ago. It might be still sensation in some other areas, but not in molecule interferometry. Okay? So much for the simple interference experiment. To stress it again, particularly the minima here. The minima are now where did I put the pointer? Here we go. The minima here are the signature of the fact that amplitudes which went through neighboring slits destructively interfere for each individual particle. I just want to tell you something about the scale of the experiment. There's all in the minds of many people, and also in bad textbooks, people pretend as if the wave were something extended and the particle were something localized. Some people even have in their mind a view of quantum mechanics which my friend Mike Horn once called the cork on the sea model. So you have the waves propagating on the sea, and they are the corks, these are the particles swimming on the sea, and they are kind of driven by the wave. Okay? There are actually more formal versions of that. One is called the de Broglie guided wave theory. Basically the same idea. Now, here in this kind of experiments, we just see the opposite. Which I should stress is not new, because that has been seen in atomic experiments already, but here it is quite striking. If I look at the C60 molecule, carbon-60 molecule here, it has a diameter of about 10 angstroms. I know it's not so obvious how to define the diameter of such an object, but give or take, define it differently, it varies maybe by 10%, but that doesn't matter. Okay? Then at the temperature at which we are working, typical temperature of 900 Kelvin, you can calculate at 900 Kelvin, you can calculate the kinetic energy, maximum kinetic energy, you can calculate the velocity, and from the velocity you can calculate the wavelength by using the de Broglie relation. Which reads lambda equals h over mv, famous relation. Okay? Calculating this, we find that the wavelength is 3 times 10 to the minus 12 meters, which is 2 orders of magnitude, nearly 3 orders of magnitude smaller than the diameter of the molecule. Okay? So that simply means that if this is the molecule, the Broglie wavelength is not much more than the width of this red line. It's even more interesting. You could then say, okay, in reality we have a wave packet, which is extended somehow. Now, if we calculate from the velocity distribution which we have, you know, the wave packet, the width of the wave packet is given by the wavelength distribution. If we calculate from the velocity distribution, the size of the wave packet, it turns out that our wave packets are, the minimal wave packets are only of 2 to 5 de Broglie wavelengths. So that means the wave packet is also very small. That simply means that our object is much, much larger than the wave. And there is no way to understand this intuitively. The wave is, and this is another important message which I believe in, you don't have to believe in, the wave is just a picture. It's just a way to calculate. It's just a way to calculate probabilities to find a particle somewhere. There is no wave out there. This is just our way to do calculations. Okay? If you would have a realistic picture, it would mean that this wave sits somewhere here at the center of mass, far away from all the atoms. Well, that's a crazy picture. So don't use waves as real. They are just a way to calculate probabilities. Now to show you some more real experiments, actually this kind of experiment, just about planning of science. I want to mention something here. I was in Innsbruck University with Markus Arndt, and on 1st of February 1999, we moved to Vienna. And within the first weeks, we sat together and said, we had started preliminary experiments for the molecule interferometer, but no results, nothing. So we decided, let's make a plan, when do we want to see molecule interference? And we made a real detailed plan. What do we need? Where are critical points? If something goes wrong, what would we do instead? And so on and so on. And our expectation was that we will see the interferences on June 5, 1999. On June 4, we saw the diffraction of the molecules at the individual slits, and on June 6, we saw the interference pattern. So you can plan science, even if you don't exactly know what you're doing. Okay, this was lucky. Anyway, so let's go on. There's an interferometer which we built. It's called a Talbot-Lau interferometer, because Talbot-Lau were two guys who worked with this near-field interferometry in the 18th century. And I should mention here that to use the Talbot-Lau interferometers for large molecules was actually proposed by a guy called John Clauser. John Clauser, he is actually the guy who did the first Bell inequality experiment. John Clauser, who wrote a beautiful paper in the 80s, How to Observe Quantum Interferences of Rocks. Okay, he's this kind of person who puts out challenging titles. Okay, and he realized that with standard interferometers, which have been built, as I mentioned, for neutrons, for electrons, also for atoms. There was the group of Dave Pritchard at MIT, and also Jürgen Blinek in Konstanz, who did this beautiful work. Is in standard interferometers, you cannot use the half-silvered mirror, usually, which I showed you, because these elements don't exist, or sometimes they exist, but they don't really work well. You need to use something else for beam splitting, and that is diffraction, as I showed it before. Because basically, when you have a diffraction grating here, you come in with the beam. It's actually a broad wavefront, clearly. When I draw something like that, I have a broad incident wavefront. You have diffraction, which means that your beam is split in various ways. Now, the point is that these are coherent with each other in the same way as the waves which you had at our semi-reflecting mirror. So if you bring them together, you can build a Mach-Zehnder interferon. How to bring them together? Very simple. Just put here another grating, where this guy will split. And for example, I don't draw all beams because that would confuse you unnecessarily. And for example, this one also splits here. So if I continue this guy and this guy, they meet again. So I put in another diffraction grating. And here the same story happens. This beam here will split into three by diffraction. I don't show the higher orders. There will be side orders also, but I don't show them. And this guy here, this guy, I make him green here so you can, this guy will also split. The important point being now that in these beams you have superposition of both possibilities. You have superposition. And it turns out that the mathematics here is nearly exactly the same as for the semi-reflecting mirror. There are some special corrections and so on, but in principle it's the same story. So you have the same story, namely I have an interferometer. I draw the interferometer now, not with all these confusing beams. I just draw the essential ones, and a little bit smaller. Here's the, oh, that doesn't matter. I come in here. here's the first mirror. I only draw the relevant beams, I don't draw the other ones. Here's the second one. And here's the third one. And I have these outgoing beams. And that is just the Mach-Zehnder interferometer again. So what you want to do is, when you observe matter wave interferences that way, you need something where you can diffract your matter waves. If you have that, you have a beam splitter. One beam splitter I showed you, these were these material gratings. Now, there's one problem. If you want to go to large masses, because of this relation, lambda equals h over mv, the wavelength gets smaller, inversely proportional to the mass. It's simply, and as you know, the diffraction grating, the size of the diffraction grating determines how wide your beams separate. Actually, the angle here, the separation beam here, theta, is of the order of lambda over d, where d is the lattice spacing. So if lambda gets smaller and smaller, the angle gets smaller and smaller, and at some point you will not separate the beams anymore, and you will not see interference fringes. Okay? And there is this trick with a near-field interferometer, where I just want to, this is just a side remark now, a near-field interferometer where you intentionally work in the regime where the interfering beams are not well separated. The point there is the following. You use what's called the Talbot effect. The phenomenon is simply that if you have a grating and you have a plane wave coming in, then it's what you actually have is you have the first order beam and you have very broad higher order beams. Broad beams now. Imagine broad beams, which are not really separated after some distance. They all superpose. At a certain distance, they superimpose in such a way that the intensity distribution reproduces the grating. So at certain distances, you get an interference pattern. If this is D, you get a pattern where the intensity is just the period of the grating. Okay? This is called the Talbot effect, and it happens at distances where, if this is L here, a distance where L is equal d squared over lambda. Okay, this is standard optics, you can look it up. Which implies now, if I want to build an interferometer with a certain length, you know, a physicist, an experimentalist always has to have practical considerations in his head. In principle, if these beams don't separate well anymore, I could just go far away. But an interferometer of 100 or 1,000 kilometers length doesn't make much sense. Okay? So, it turns out that another point would be to make our distance smaller and smaller. Would also help. If I work in this is called the Talbot length. If I work in that regime, it means that the grating constant I have to use is equal to square root of lambda L. Now, for the experimentalist, this is great news. It means that if I go to shorter wavelength, say 100 times smaller wavelengths. I only have to use structures which are 10 times finer and not 100 times finer. And an experiment becomes suddenly possible, which would be impossible otherwise. I don't have to look at the time now. How long should I talk? Okay. Okay. So this is a Talbot interferometer. A Talbot Lau interferometer uses this near field diffraction phenomenon. I don't know whether near field diffraction is still taught in optics. If not, then tell everybody that it should. Okay. What it boils down to in the end is that you have three gratings. In a sense, the first two gratings prepare the plane wave for the specialists here. And back there, you get an intensity pattern of the molecules, the standing wave pattern in space, which you then can sample moving a third grating across. So what happens is there's a standing pattern. If the standing pattern is such that the atoms can go through the openings of the grating, then you get maximum intensity. If it's just shifted by half a period, you get minimal intensity. Okay. This instrument we feel is very important to go, as I mentioned before, to go to much larger molecules. So one thing which we tested was the following. One could simply think or believe or expect, or I don't know what kind of word to use, that for these early experiments which I mentioned, it was crucial that the molecules have a high symmetry. Because as you remember, from the Bohr talk, from the old Bohr days, as soon as we know which path the particle goes through, the interference disappears. So which means the more the particle interacts with the environment, the more information is present where it goes through. So if it doesn't interact very much, maybe the interference survives better. So the question was, and this is clearly related to the symmetry of the molecule. So one question was, does the symmetry play a role? And we did an experiment with these porphyrin molecules here. It's actually a very complicated molecule. You are all physicists, so you know even less than I do, a theoretical physicist, so you know even less than I do about these molecules. These porphyrin molecules play an essential role both in hemoglobin and in chlorophyll, both in plants and in blood. But the important point here for us is that these molecules are not at all highly symmetric. They are basically flat, pancake shaped. They have four ears sticking out, and their ears are not even at right angle. They are tilted, and so on and so on. Mm-hmm. With these molecules, we could see quantum interference here, and with the theoretically expected visibility. So there's no indication whatsoever that the symmetry might play a role. Another little small experiment which you might be interested in is a pedagogic experiment. It's an experiment on Heisenberg uncertainty for macromolecules. We all know that if we define the position very well, then the momentum becomes undefined. And the simplest way to define position, because of the Heisenberg uncertainty relation. Okay, I should write it on the table. Everybody knows it, but I write it on the table anyway. Delta X times delta P is greater or equal H bar over 2. Heisenberg uncertainty. For anyone working practically in the laboratory, the relationship really means delta x delta p is greater or approximately equal to h. This is a practical rule of thumb for most experiments. As you know, this form of the uncertainty principle only holds for Gaussian wave packets. And that's very rare that you encounter those. Okay? Okay, so you get the momentum uncertainty if you define the position very well. And this we did in a small little experiment by introducing a fine slit that could be varied between 0.05 and 20 micrometer. You can imagine it's not easy to build slits which you can vary that way. There are not many people who build them such that the slit, the sides, the jaws of the slit move very nicely and so on, and measure the distribution of the molecules back there. Here are the experimental results, just as expected. This is not a, you know, this is not a sensation, just a demonstration. The distribution of the molecules for two different slit widths, 1.4 micrometers and 0.07 micrometers. Narrow distribution, wide distribution. And here is the molecular beam width, the measured width of the distribution of the molecules in the observation plane. Here in the observation plane distribution, so the width of these peaks here, width of these peaks, as a function of slit width. So when you have a large slit, the observed pattern gets narrower, clearly. I mean, if I have a door, light shines through, I close it, the distribution gets narrower. But when you enter the quantum regime, when diffraction sets in, when Heisenberg sets in, for narrow slits, the distribution gets wider again. Now, this is, as I mentioned, it's just a demonstration now. But from a practical point of view, it is important. As I mentioned before in these experiments, let's go back here. If you look at this experiment, I said that we observe interference because the molecules pass through neighboring slits. No, I didn't say that. I said that the interference is due to amplitudes passing through neighboring slits. So we have to illuminate the two slits coherently. Okay, it must be the same coherent wave illuminating both slits. And this is guaranteed by that first slit up here, by diffraction at that first slit up there. Okay, so Heisenberg diffraction at the first slit prepares a coherent wavefront, and that then allows you to observe the interference. Okay, let's get back to where we were. After these experiments, we were interested in studying decoherence. We were interested in trying to find out how, under which circumstances, the interference pattern would disappear due to interaction with the environment. The basic pattern is that as long as there is no information present anywhere in the universe, which path the particle takes, you see interference pattern. As soon as the information is present somewhere, the interference pattern disappears, independent of whether you care to read it out or not. Sometimes, you know, in some discussions of interpretations, people say that it's important whether the observer knows which path the particle goes through. But this determines whether you see interference fringes or not. This is simply wrong. The observer doesn't have to know anything, doesn't care. Nature doesn't care about the observer. But the question is whether whether someone could read out the information, whether someone could determine which path the particle went, whether this is possible or not. In principle, as Feynman says, you see interference fringes or not. So we have to ask ourselves, how can information, which path the that the particle takes be carried into the environment. And there are two ways which we investigated. One is scattering by background gas. Really, if you have molecules scattered at these background gas molecules, scattered at these big molecules, then by looking at the molecule, you could in principle find out whether it was kicked here or here, whether it was kicked here or here. Never mind that we are not able to do this experiment, but in principle the possibility is there. And it turns out in this kind of experiment, what we did is we played with various gases, various different densities, and it turns out that a single kick of a molecule in general is enough to destroy interference. A single kick by a molecule, by a small molecule with a big one, destroys interference. The situation is slightly more tricky if you consider the interaction with photons. If you consider the interaction with light, you could imagine, I mean, these molecules are hot. These molecules emit photons, they emit light. So in principle, all you need to do is, if they're hot enough, just take a microscope and see if the molecule takes this path or this path. So you would say, okay, if the molecule emits light along the path, interference pattern is destroyed. But that's not in general true. The point is that you have to be able to find out which path the particle takes. So it depends on the wavelengths of the radiation emitted. If the wavelength of the radiation emitted is long enough such that if you would look at it with a microscope, you would not be able to tell whether the molecule took this path or this path, then the interference pattern is still there. The resolution of every molecule is given by the wavelengths which you look at. Basically, it's limited by the wavelengths. There are some prefactors like aperture and so on, but that is not important for our discussion. Okay, so if the wavelength is long enough, the resolution of the molecule is bad enough, you cannot determine which path the particle took. So in a sense, if the wavelength is long enough, the molecule emits a photon, or more than one photon, but it doesn't know whether it emitted the photon along this path or along this path. So interference is still there. On the other hand, if the wavelength is short enough, then you can, if you have enough of them, then you can expect the structure of interference. Now, in the experiment, itself is really quite interesting, the way it works. We have our molecules coming here, and I just go through the story slowly here. Molecules coming here, passing through multiple laser beams, such that they get heated up to significant temperatures. After coming out of this multi-beam arrangement, we estimate the temperature of these molecules to be of the order of 5,000 Kelvin. That's quite hot. You can ask yourself, why does the molecule not break apart? The reason simply is that cooling by emission of radiation is a faster process than breaking up. Okay? So the molecules are very, very hot, then they emit a lot of photons and get cold enough such that they don't break apart anymore, in a simple picture. Mostly, yes. Wien's displacement law. Ah, ba-bo, 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 lambda. I don't know, I have to... Next, yeah, that's a good point, actually. Give it to the student as an exercise. Right. Okay, so the molecules cool down to temperatures of the order of 2 to 3,000 K, depending on how high you heated them up here. And for the interferometer, it doesn't matter whether they were hot before or not, because and whether they emit a radiation before, because that doesn't tell you anything about the interference path. Now, here is, you get the wavefront. Excuse the naive picture of a wavefront. I told you before that there are no waves out there, but this is just a way to imagine what goes on. And you get, you know, the two wavefronts, which then are supposed to superpose. And then at some point, if the fullerene might emit a photon, and that photon might allow you to find out where the fullerene was and kill the interference pattern. Okay. These are various interference patterns measured for different laser power. Here you see the laser power, 0, 5 volt, and so on, which doesn't mean much for you yet. And you see, for high enough power, the interference pattern disappears. Okay. Actually, there's an interesting point here. The total intensity increases in the beginning, as you will see now. The total intensity increases and then decreases. The increasing is due to the fact that these are carbon 70 molecules, that that hot molecules are easier to detect than cold molecules. And the decrease is simply due to because molecules break up in the end. These are just, we don't want to go through this. Let me go here. The question is how to understand this quantitatively. And the experiment was mainly done by Lucia Hackermüller, PhD student, and the theory was done by Klaus Hornberger. Klaus Hornberger is now a junior professor in Munich. He was a postdoc with us for some time. Klaus Hornberger then basically calculated the expected decrease of visibility as a function of heating power. Visibility means simply the visibility is defined of the interference pattern. If I have an interference, that's actually an important parameter in all these experiments. I have an interference pattern here, and I have a minimal intensity. This is the intensity, I min, and I have a maximal intensity, I max. And the visibility is defined as I max minus I min divided by I max plus I min. That's a very important parameter in all these experiments. Also in entangled photon experiments, Gregor had to worry a lot about his visibility in his experiments, and so on and so on. Okay? So clearly, if you have 100% fringes, if this goes down to zero, the visibility is 1. And if I max is equal I min, so if the thing is flat, you get 0 visibility. Up there is the temperature of the molecules at the moment when they enter the first grating. And now you see something interesting. The agreement between theory and experiment is, you won't believe it, excellent, even as this looks, but given the complicated system, this is actually fantastic. But the more, to me, the important point is, even at temperatures nearly to 3,000 Kelvin, 2,800 Kelvin, you still have quantum interference. So you don't need to cool your stuff down. So I'm slowly coming to the end of my talk. You know, so we have seen interferences of macromolecules. The record is actually some more complicated molecules than these fullerenes, but that's a different story. And Markus Arndt with his group now, as I told you, we have now separated our groups. He works on his own. Markus Arndt is now working towards interference of really big biologically relevant molecules. So we might again talk about Schrödinger's cat and the superposition of dead and alive cats and so on. I believe that basically, number one is, one should only, I know I'm the only one who says this, But one should only talk about cats when we can hear them meow. So I would not claim that in any of our experiments we have seen Schrödinger cat states, even as other people would say we have observed Schrödinger cat states. But this is, I don't know, a cat has to say meow. That's it, right? And it's not really Marco's topic. But the more important point is we might now fantasize a little bit. How far could we go with these quantum interference experiments? Now, based on our knowledge now, remember we saw quantum interference of these molecules at rather heavy molecules already, carbon 70, a rather heavy molecule, at temperatures up to 3000 Kelvin. Okay? You can now make reasonable estimates how and the decoherence is due to emission of radiation into the environment. You now can make estimates how this would scale with temperature using a kind of Stefan Boltzmann law and also taking into account the wavelengths, the Wien law. And you can also estimate the emissivity, how the emissivity of your molecules changes with size. And if you do this, then we can safely predict that in this kind of experiment, with the kind of geometry which we are using, there will be no problem for masses up to 10 to the 7 atomic mass units. At present, we are at about 10 to the 3 atomic mass units. No problem at masses up to about 10 to the 7 atomic mass units at room temperature. So at temperatures where biological systems work. Okay? So 10 to the 7. So the only question is how to do this practically. 10 to the 7 atomic mass units at room temperature, at here about 300 Kelvin. We should still see very good interference. Now, an interesting point is that 10 to the 7 atomic mass units is the size of small viruses. Okay? And we might now speculate how could we go on. I mean, I'm sure once we are there, once we can do this kind of experiments, we will easily see how to go on. And I'm pretty sure that we will see the day when people see quantum interferences, for example, of small bacteria, nanobacteria. There's a group of bacteria which are called nanobacteria because they're so small. I should say one thing about Schrödinger's cat experiment. You know, now I'm really, you know, take me as a very optimistic experimentalist now. You know, we have this field of nanotechnology that people start building, you know, fantastic machines on the nanometer scale, basically putting them together atom by atom. I cannot see any reason. I mean, the problem with Schrödinger's cat clearly is that this cat has to be alive or dead, and you don't want to kill it by putting the cat in high vacuum, for example. Okay? So you have to provide the cat with its life support system. Okay? Now, for a cat, I don't want to make any statement about quantum interference of cats. But we can imagine now, if we have a little fantasy, and if we are optimistic about technological development, we can imagine taking a nanobacteria, a really living bacteria, built with nanotechnology, a life support system around this bacteria, which provides it with all it needs, but shields it so completely from the environment that it can stay alive in vacuum, even maybe at low temperatures. And putting such a system through an interferometer is not different than putting a speck of dust through an interferometer. So I bet this kind of experiment will be done someday. And with this optimistic outlook into the future, I would like to stop. Well, could we turn on the light in the room more now for the discussion? Thank you. The question is, how does this relate to the Schrödinger's cat? Because in the cat case, it's dead or alive. We have a superposition dead. Here we have the superposition of something being here or being there, in the life system being here, being there. Well, it's a superposition of a living system in two different ways. And I guess we sit down with a glass of beer, we probably can modify my experiment into one where the molecule is alive and one part is dead on the other.